What happens when businesses make unlocking the power of their data an organizational and cultural imperative? Find out in The Data Agenda, a new podcast series from Wall Street Journal Custom Content and Amazon Web Services, available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
This is your tech news briefing for Monday, February 14th. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. For decades, computer simulations have been used to try and forecast how the world's environment is changing. But scientists say even the best tools at hand can't model the global climate with the sureness the world needs. On today's show, science writer Robert Lee Hotz will be here to discuss the challenges that climate forecasters are facing and how they're working to overcome them. That's after these headlines. TikTok is updating the community guidelines on its app, explicitly banning misogyny, misgendering, and deadnaming, or the use of a transgender individual's birth name if they've changed it. The video sharing platform says the steps will help promote safety, security, and well-being for its users. The move comes as several organizations, including ones representing the LGBTQ community, have urged TikTok to be clearer about what language and activities aren't permitted on its platform. TikTok uses both technology and people to identify and remove posts that violate its rules, and it said the new guidelines will be implemented over the coming weeks. The Senate Judiciary Committee passed a bill that would hold internet platforms liable for child sex abuse content on their websites. The Earn It Act, which passed with bipartisan support, would scale back immunities that internet platforms have under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina at the hearing.
Our goal is to tell the social media companies, get involved and stop this crap.
Yeah.
And if you don't take responsibility for what's on your platform, then Section 230 will not be there for you.
Industry groups representing big tech, including Facebook parent Meta and Google parent Alphabet, have been working to stop the measure. Some privacy and human rights advocates have also opposed it, saying it could lead to censorship of content created by diverse groups, like the LGBTQ community. The bill now moves to the full Senate floor. And SpaceX expects launches to get a whole lot cheaper. CEO Elon Musk said within 2 or 3 years, the company's most powerful rocket, the Starship, could reach orbit for less than $10 million a flight. Once the ship gets regulators' approval to launch, that is. Musk also said SpaceX would relocate the launch site of Starship to Florida if regulators decide to do an environmental study of its current Texas launch site. The Federal Aviation Administration previously said it could require additional analysis if it finds that Starship's impact to the launch site in Texas could be significant. Our reporter Micah Maidenberg says the rocket would be the biggest ever to be sent into orbit.
Starship is the company's, massive rocket that is meant for basically its most ambitious missions, including to the moon, potentially to Mars. One of the big challenges with Starship is that it's meant to be sort of fully and rapidly reusable. And, if you pull that off, you can, lower the cost of getting to space. That would mean lower costs for customers that would get on board.
All right, coming up, those clouds in the sky may be pretty, but they're also causing a headache for scientists trying to understand climate change. We'll explain after the break.
The world's best-run companies count on GEP software and services to transform their supply chains, meet their biggest challenges, and gain serious competitive advantage. GEP.com.
To help prepare for the challenges brought on by climate change, governments, businesses, and international organizations all rely on climate models. They're the best tool we have to predict our environmental future. But as scientists gather more data and policymakers search for more precise forecasts, these models are running up against the limits of both human power and computing power. Joining us to discuss these challenges and how scientists and computer engineers are working to overcome them is science writer Robert Lee Hotz. Hi, Lee.
It's always grand to talk to you all about these things.
Okay, so let's start with some really basic ideas. Why do we need climate models in the first place?
Well, that's actually a great question. And The reason we need them is because this is the only way that we can conduct experiments in the future of our planet. Climate models really put the planet in a digital test tube. I mean, they are, for better or worse, computer programs that serve as prediction machines. We need to know what the future of climate change will bring. And as policymakers around the world negotiate emission controls on carbon dioxide or methane and other greenhouse gases that contribute to rising temperatures, we all urgently need to know the impact of these changes we might make.
Okay, so explain to me a little bit about the information that's used to create the models and why it can be so difficult to come up with an accurate model.
Well, let's consider like the history here. So we, the world scientific community, have been developing climate models since the 1960s. When climate modeling first started, there were three real drawbacks from our perspective today. The physics of global climate change with all of its interplay of order and disorder on scales ranging from molecules to the entire planet, that was still in its infancy. There also was almost no comprehensive global climate data about historical or ancient climate changes that we could really use to gauge what was happening to us now. And last but not least, the computers themselves, while revolutionary for their day, were rudimentary.
I wonder now that we have, you know, faster supercomputers and, you know, more programming power and a lot more data, if there are still significant challenges to creating accurate climate models.
Well, the big challenge now, they're twofold. One is our understanding of the physics has now gotten so sophisticated and so micro that it's in fact more than the fastest supercomputers can digest and process in a timely way. And at the same time, the amount of data that is available, real-time data from satellites, from ocean buoys, from temperature stations all over the world is now so immense, it's more than we can store and manage and analyze. And this is a huge technical challenge now that people are wrestling with. It's starting to draw on machine learning, on artificial intelligence. It's having to make them even change how they store this information.
Given all of that data and given all of that processing power, even when they're creating more and getting newer computers, how accurate does it mean these models are today?
Well, they are predictions. But when scientists recently evaluated 17 models used between 1970 and 2007, they found that most predicted climate shifts were literally indistinguishable from what actually eventually occurred in the real world. So the fact that these early models get it right should give us, you know, some confidence in the more advanced and more sophisticated models we use now.
I want to talk about one factor that is apparently making it difficult to get some of these climate models right, and that's clouds. Why are clouds such a problem for climate modelers?
Clouds, you know, we take them for granted. They are the most amazing things, and they really are the most serious issue complicating researchers' attempts to figure out how to predict climate change most accurately. And the reason is that clouds reflect or trap the heat from the sun. At any given time, I mean, two-thirds of the Earth's surface is covered with clouds of one sort or another. And whether those clouds are high altitude or low altitude, or whether they're being created and persisting in during the nighttime or during daylight, whether they're low altitude, high altitude, low latitude, high latitude, every single one of them, I forget how many kinds of clouds there are, but there are dozens of kinds of clouds, and each one of them affects climate differently. And we still don't know enough about how clouds serve as the kind of controlling feedback mechanism on our global climate. And this is in part because clouds are hard to study at this level of detail. But in terms of climate modeling, you're now talking about a physical phenomenon that on the one hand operates on a scale of half the planet, but also down to the level of microscopic water drops.
I wonder what comes next for the world of climate modeling and for the world because of climate modeling.
Well, it's a complicated question because these are things that run on parallel tracks, I guess is the best way. The scientists are developing climate models, and they, of course, operate on a schedule that's dictated by their creativity, their imagination, their funding, and their own particular research goals. They feed into a international process kind of orchestrated by the United Nations that kind of runs on a 10-year cycle. Every 10 years or so, the world goes through a major update of its standard climate model conclusions. And for instance, that's what we're in the middle of right now. The most recent UN IPCC report, which came out, I guess, in last August, one of the key things there was evaluating and sorting through these 100 climate models. Now, it will be another 10 years or so before we go back and update that standard. Now, while that's going on, climate modelers are busy improving their systems, and they're wrestling with all of the factors that we've been discussing here today. I mean, just the data alone is stunning. I mean, I was talking to the U.S. officials who manage the repositories for climate-related information in this country, and they expect their data archives for climate change information, the volume, to grow from about 83 petabytes today total to more than 650 petabytes in a decade. Now, just for reference, a single petabyte of digital memory can hold thousands of feature-length movies. And so 650 petabytes that they're expecting, that's enough to hold the contents of the Library of Congress 30 times over. It's just a stunning amount of information to have to digest as a computational matter.
All right, that was our science writer, Robert Lee Hotz. Thanks for joining us, Lee.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about this.
And that's it for Tech News Briefing. If you want more tech stories, check out our website, WSJ.com. And if you like our show, please rate and review it. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.